From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief, James Bennett, about covering the conflict in the Middle East. He travels back and forth between Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, covering the attacks, talking with Israelis and Palestinians about their lives, and reporting on diplomatic efforts. In today's Times, he has the lead story on Dick Cheney's visit. In the current bestseller, Bias, author Bernard Goldberg claims that the media tend to use the label conservative more than the label liberal. Linguist Jeff Nunberg decided to do some checking of his own. He'll tell us the results. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon is finishing up its rules for military tribunals for prisoners caught in Afghanistan and will give Congress a look at them tomorrow. As NPR's Barbara Bradley reports, the new rules are tailored to blunt congressional criticism.
When the tribunals were first announced, critics went through the roof. They said based on the skeleton plan, the tribunals could be turned into kangaroo courts, held in secret with no right of appeal. Even the death penalty could be given with a two-thirds vote. Somewhat taken aback, Defense Department lawyers began writing, and the final product, sources say, is far less incendiary. Once the president decides to bring a detainee to trial, a series of rights kicks in. The accused is presumed innocent. He has a right to a free military attorney. He can see the evidence against him. He can be convicted on two-thirds vote, but receives the death penalty only with a unanimous vote. There are some differences, however. It will be much easier to get hearsay or secondhand evidence into court, and the accused can appeal the verdict, but only to a review board. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Vice President Dick Cheney said today that he's willing to meet with Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat, but only on condition that the Palestinians accept and abide by a ceasefire with Israel.
The tenant work plan requires 100% effort by Chairman Arafat to stop the violence and the terror, and I would expect the 100% effort to begin immediately.
Negotiators for the two sides say a truce could be declared as early as tomorrow. Pakistan has fired the police chief in the capital city after Sunday's grenade attack on a Christian church. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from Islamabad.
President Pervez Musharraf also dismissed four senior police commanders in the wake of the attack. It happened on one of Islamabad's most secure streets, where police checkpoints guarded the approaches to the nearby U.S. embassy. Somebody made it past those checkpoints and walked into the church throwing hand grenades. Five people died, including two Americans. Police say they're still not certain if the attacker ever walked out again. Police say that nobody saw the attacker leave, and so authorities are asking if he might have died in the attack. Pakistani authorities are still studying one badly damaged body from the bombing. The body remains unidentified, and nobody has claimed it. Authorities are taking DNA samples from the remains and sending them to the United States in case that helps them to trace the dead man's identity. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Islamabad.
CIA Director George Tenet said today that the Al-Qaeda terror network remains a threat to Americans. Tenet told the Senate Armed Services Committee that Al-Qaeda leaders are regrouping and trying to resume terrorist activities. In stocks today, the Dow gained 57 points to close at 10,635. The Nasdaq gained 3 points to close at 1880. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve decided not to change short-term interest rates this month. The Fed's monetary policymakers left the federal funds rate at 1.75%. That's the lowest it's been in 40 years. Illinois voters are casting ballots in the state's primary election today. In this election, Cook County becomes the first county in the nation to use machines to scan ballots for mistakes. Lisa Labas reports from Chicago Public Radio.
The new machines show two kinds of mistakes: overvotes if a person picked more than one candidate in a race, and undervotes if a person didn't choose any candidate in a race. Voters then have a chance to correct their mistakes. Christian Smith is an election judge on Chicago's North Side.
A lot of people are making mistakes, over-punching, under-punching, and a lot of people are just leaving it the way it is. They don't want to go back into the booth.
There have been only a couple minor glitches so far. Officials say the equipment is working very well, but some election workers are having to adjust to the new system. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labas in Chicago.
A Los Angeles jury is considering the fate of a San Francisco couple whose dogs mauled a neighbor woman to death more than a year ago. Marjorie Knoller could face up to 15 years in prison if she's convicted of second-degree murder and other charges stemming from the attack that killed Diane Whipple. Knoller's husband, who is not present during the attack, faces lesser charges. The case has drawn widespread attention because it focuses on the responsibility of the dog owners in keeping potentially dangerous animals. Prosecutors have called witnesses who described other cases of threatening behavior by the big Presa Canario dogs. The defense has said the couple had no warning that their dogs could be dangerous. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the James Irvine Foundation, supporting NPR's West Coast expansion, www.irvine.org, partners in building a better California.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his position as Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, James Bennett is covering both sides of the Middle East conflict. He's been writing about the tit-for-tat attacks and how they're affecting the daily lives of Israelis and Palestinians. And he's been covering diplomatic efforts to bring the two sides back to the negotiating table. Today he has the lead story in the New York Times, reporting on how Israel has started withdrawing from Palestinian-controlled territory in three West Bank towns, moving under American pressure toward meeting Palestinian conditions for ceasefire talks. Bennett's report also covers Vice President Dick Cheney's visit to Israel, where he met with President Ariel Sharon and reaffirmed the Bush administration's commitment to helping end the violence. Cheney said that he would consider meeting with Arafat if Arafat does his part to achieve a ceasefire. The main goal of Cheney's trip to the region is to mobilize support in Arab countries for U.S. plans to attack Iraq. This morning, I spoke to James Bennett, who's in Jerusalem, and asked if he thought that Cheney brought both sides any closer to the negotiating table.
It wasn't really part of his mission here, and I don't think in the end it's something he accomplished. He hadn't even scheduled in arriving here. He hadn't scheduled any meetings with any Palestinian officials, which caused something of a flap with the Palestinian leadership. By the time he got here, Cheney's people were saying, well, he's left some room on his schedule for a possible meeting. Palestinians at that point were quite miffed, and they said he'll meet with Yasser Arafat or he won't meet with any Palestinian officials. Vice President Cheney wasn't about to meet with Yasser Arafat. George Bush has categorically refused to meet with him so far, and that would be regarded as simply too great a concession. So that didn't happen, and there were some bruised feelings on both sides. In an effort to repair that today, the Vice President said, well, he will meet with Yasser Arafat as soon as the Palestinians agree to enter a formal ceasefire arrangement with the Israelis.
So what kind of reaction was Dick Cheney getting in the Middle East to the American plan to possibly attack Iraq?
He kept trying to talk about that subject. In return, he kept hearing from Arab states that the U.S. had to first address the conflict here. There was not, as you would expect, great enthusiasm for the idea of another war on Iraq. He encountered a lot of resistance to that idea in the Arab states. The Israelis are more enthusiastic about the idea, in fact, four square behind it. But over and over again, he kept hearing the same thing, which is that the Arab states expect him to do something about the problem here. They want to see Yasser Arafat freed from the West Bank, and in particular the city of Ramallah, where Israel has effectively been holding him a captive for the last 3 months. They want him to be able to attend the summit meeting next week of Arab states in Beirut, March 27th and March 28th. The Israeli press has reported that Dick Cheney was privately pressing Ariel Sharon to let Arafat go next week to Beirut. But Mr. Sharon said today that he would permit Yasser Arafat to go if he meets certain conditions. And then he said, well, he might not let him come back if he gives a bad speech while he's there.
Let's talk a little bit about how tactics have changed on each side. Let's start with the Israelis. What are the Israelis doing now that they perhaps didn't do in previous high points of the conflict with the Palestinians?
Well, the last 2 weeks brought basically the largest Israeli military operation in 20 years, and their largest operation in the West Bank and Gaza since they first conquered those territories in 1967. There'd been a number of pretty devastating suicide attacks in Israel. There was growing political frustration here among Israelis that the government had failed to address their security concerns. Ariel Sharon was elected on a promise of peace and security, and violence, if anything, had only grown after a year in office. And so in late February, they launched this sweeping operation to raid Palestinian refugee camps, which they'd never attacked before. And we had soldiers essentially going into these camps, taking them over, and going house to house, searching for militants, searching for weapons. And in many cases, these invasions produced firefights that that left dozens of Palestinians dead overall.
What is your understanding of what the Israeli mission is in entering the refugee camps?
Well, the Israelis said they were simply left no option, that they had to do something about what they called a rising tide of terrorism, and they had to attack it at its source, that Palestinians were treating these refugee camps as havens, believing the Israelis would never enter them, that they were using them as bomb-making factories, and that many of the most wanted militants were hiding out in them. In fact, the Israelis weren't able to round up many of those people, the people they regard as the truly bad guys, because they simply melted away from the camps and vanished into the civilian population elsewhere. But Israel claimed success for it, partly because they said that they also just managed to kill a large number of Palestinian gunmen. From the Palestinian perspective, these raids into the camps were an attempt by Israel to reoccupy territory that is supposed to, by treaty, to be Palestinian controlled, and they view it as part of a master plan by Mr. Sharon to eventually reoccupy the whole West Bank and Gaza Strip, something that Sharon denies, of course.
You recently reported from the largest refugee camp in the West Bank, Balada. Would you describe what the camp looks like and what life is like there now?
Well, this, like other refugee camps, was established in 1948 after the Israeli-Arab War. And the people that are living there have been there now for half a century. They've had children, they've had grandchildren. The place was originally a collection of tents. It's now a tightly packed warren of cinder block houses, one after another, pressed up against each other. People have thrown up extra floors willy-nilly. In all these refugee camps, 50% of the population is under 18. There are vast number of children milling in the streets with nothing to do. The United Nations runs actually fairly good schools in a lot of these camps. But the people there still live in great poverty. Many of them still have their deeds to their homes in the land that is now Israel. They dream still of returning there. Some even still have the keys to their houses. And when you ask them where they're from, even the second or third generation that lives there, they don't tell you Balata refugee camp. They tell you Jaffa or Haifa, Israeli cities. And they still expect to return home to those cities someday. And as a result, their claims have created one of the most difficult political problems between Israelis and Palestinians.
The right of return.
Exactly, the right of return.
You've described in your writing how a lot of younger Palestinians have every intention to returning to a home that doesn't necessarily even exist anymore. They have keys to houses that don't exist anymore in communities that have totally changed since 1948 when their families left. And these are places that the younger people have never even seen.
That's right. In some cases, they have gone home. The parents took them back. I interviewed recently a leader of the Islamic group Hamas in a refugee camp in northern Gaza called Jabalia. And he would, when Gaza was still open and he could travel more freely, he would take his family to picnic on the ruins of their old house, a place he had never lived himself, by the way. He was born in Jabalia. Even if they've never been there, the children have been raised on Edenic images of what life was like in their home. And they carry visions of a paradise lost with them. And compared to the circumstances in which they now find themselves, often of extreme poverty, in camps where the sewage is not too great, where unemployment, particularly during the conflict, has climbed to probably well over 50%, and the poverty rate is also about that high, people living on less than $3 a day. Compared to that, the visions that they carry with them, they really treasure.
So we'll talk about the right of return and how that figures into the peace equation a little bit later, but I want to get back to how tactics on each side have changed. You said that the Israelis have, you know, in the past few weeks sent tanks into some of the refugee camps. How have Palestinian tactics changed in this second intifada?
Well, there's been a really important shift in just the last couple of months. Most of this, up until the beginning of this year, most of the really devastating attacks, particularly the suicide attacks within pre-1967 Israel, that is, not in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, most of those attacks were carried out by Hamas, which is an Islamic extremist group. Since mid-January, we've seen militants from Yasser Arafat's own Fatah faction, which is a more mainstream, somewhat more secular organization. Those Palestinians have been conducting the lion's share of attacks. They've been carrying out suicide attacks in Israel. They've also stepped up, very importantly, have stepped up their attacks on Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They think that there's more international sympathy for those types of attacks than for suicide attacks in Jerusalem. Extremism is so rife now, really on both sides, but on the Palestinian side, that this stepped-up violence by Fatah militants has helped restore Fatah's popularity and Yasser Arafat's popularity.
Now, you spoke with Arafat's top Fatah lieutenant, Marwan Barghouti, and you asked him to talk about these attacks of Israelis in the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, and he defended those attacks. What was his defense?
Well, his view, and the view of most Palestinians, is that the Israelis are occupiers of the West Bank and Gaza, that it's land that should be returned to the Palestinians, that settlers are a form of illegal occupation and essentially equivalent to the soldiers at the checkpoints. So they regard them as legitimate targets. Marwan Barghouti and other Palestinians are now saying there can be no ceasefire until Israel entirely leaves those territories. He says he still believes in a two-state solution, that once Israel is out of the West Bank and Gaza, that will pave the way for real peace and real reconciliation. But that as long as Israel is still there, that's de facto a violation of a ceasefire, that it is in effect an act of violence and an assault on the Palestinian people, so that there can be no truce as long as there are still soldiers and settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
My guest is James Bennett, the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett. He's the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief, and he's speaking to us from Jerusalem. No, Israeli officials have said that it's impossible to negotiate with Arafat because Arafat hasn't held Palestinians accountable for suicide bombings. He hasn't tried to stop them. They hold Arafat accountable for a lot of the Palestinian violence, although Arafat says, you know, that he's done his best. If it is Fatah, which is part of the same group that Arafat belongs to, if it is Fatah that is behind some of the attacks in the West Bank and Gaza against Israelis, what does that say about Arafat and his willingness to stop attacks on Israelis?
That willingness has declined dramatically in the last few months. And Yasser Arafat declared a ceasefire on December 16th under enormous American pressure. and other international pressure. That ceasefire essentially unraveled after about 3 weeks. Both sides claim, hold the other side responsible for the collapse of the ceasefire. From the Palestinian perspective, Israel destroyed the ceasefire by killing a very popular Fatah militant leader in the West Bank city of Tulkarm, a guy named Raed Karmi. That was a pivotal event, for at least from the Palestinian perspective. Since then, from that killing is when we can really date this enormous rise in Fatah attacks and their increasing use of suicide as a tactic, which is not something they had embraced earlier. Since then, the violence has really risen almost out of control here. The Bush administration had said over and over again that it wasn't really prepared to engage here until both parties were prepared to embrace a ceasefire, that Yasser Arafat really needed to do more to crack down on violence before he could expect much help from the United States. In fact, what's happened in the end is that the United States has re-engaged precisely because the violence had gotten so bad. And so from a Palestinian perspective, it looks like violence works. It looks like the only thing that Israelis and the Bush administration understand and respond to is force.
One other question in terms of how tactics are changing on both sides of the Middle East conflict now. Israel has been holding Yasser Arafat basically under house arrest for several weeks. Has Israel ever done anything like that before?
Well, arguably this whole experience is a replay of what happened in Lebanon 20 years ago when Ariel Sharon was defense minister and Yasser Arafat was in Beirut. Israel invaded Lebanon, supposedly just to clear away its northern borders, but the troops wound up going right up to Beirut and besieging Beirut, where Yasser Arafat was effectively besieged, as he has been besieged recently in Ramallah. Both men, Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat, are accused here of essentially replaying that drama now in the territory, the West Bank and Gaza and Israel itself, that lies at the core of their dispute.
How is holding Arafat under house arrest seen by each side? How do the Israelis see it? How do the Palestinians see it?
Well, I should say first that Israel is now slowly letting Arafat out of its captivity. It said now that he is free to move in the West Bank, although as soon as they announced that, they attacked Ramallah and made it impossible for him to move again. And they say they may even let him go to Beirut next week if he meets certain conditions for the Arab summit there. But in general, Israelis have been overwhelmingly approving of this effort. And in fact, they favor the idea now of expelling Arafat from the territories altogether. Yasser Arafat is a very unpopular man in Israel, and many people have given up on the notion of him as a peace partner. On the Palestinian side, this whole effort by Israel has backfired. It's made Yasser Arafat more popular. People have thought that he's effectively now more a symbol of their plight than ever. They're familiar with Israeli checkpoints, virtual blockades of Palestinian cities, not being free to move around. Now they see their leader in the same predicament, and they feel a greater identification with him. We've seen in polls that Yasser Arafat's popularity has climbed since he's been under house arrest.
You recently pointed out what I thought was a very interesting statistic, which is that during the first Intifada, almost 15 years ago, roughly one Israeli died for every 25 Palestinians that were killed. And that ratio has narrowed that now. It's about one Israeli for about every three Palestinians killed. What accounts for that narrowing, and how is that kind of affecting how this conflict is playing out?
The first conflict was much more of a sort of spontaneous uprising, children with stones, flinging them at Israeli soldiers. This is much more like a combination of a guerrilla war and in some cases, a terrorist enterprise, armed gunmen versus soldiers. Israel still retains overwhelming force of arms. Israel's a nuclear power. It has tanks. It has armored vehicles. But the Palestinians have become much more sophisticated in their tactics, in the way they attack Israeli soldiers in particular. They've now managed to destroy two Israeli tanks since last month. In 18 years of occupation by Israel in South Lebanon, the militant group Hezbollah never managed to destroy an Israeli tank. The relative increase of Israeli deaths is having a real profound political effect on Israel. Sharon campaigned on this promise of peace and security, and in fact, Israel is losing more of its citizens than it has in any such previous conflict, and there's a lot of pressure on him now to do something about it, one way or another. On the one hand, you're seeing increasing calls for drastic measures. 46% of the Jewish population of Israel now favors what's known as transfer, somehow moving the Palestinians away from Gaza Strip and West Bank. On the other hand, you're seeing left-wingers wanting to build a fence and unilaterally withdraw behind it and simply leave the Palestinian territories. Neither option is terribly realistic.
What's the most optimistic move toward talks, toward peace talks that you see happening now?
Well, last week the Bush administration returned General Anthony Zinni, its special envoy, to the region. He'd been here twice before, failed both times to get any kind of ceasefire. The administration had been very reluctant to send him back here until there was some sign that both sides were willing to, particularly the Palestinian side, was willing to retreat from the use of violence, but there was no sign that that was going to happen. There's actually been two relatively quiet days here, though the violence has continued, but General Zinni has succeeded in getting security chiefs from both sides to meet again. The Israelis have now withdrawn from Bethlehem and Beit Jala and some areas of the Gaza Strip, Palestinian-controlled territory that they had recently invaded. Palestinian leadership says that's still not enough. They want to see more Israeli withdrawals from other areas that by treaty is supposed to be under Palestinian control. But there is some sign that both sides want to pull back from the brink. Whether this is more than a temporary lull, it's hard to say right now. The dynamic is certainly all in the other direction. That is working against General Zinni's effort.
James Bennett recorded earlier today from Jerusalem. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities, and Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by H.W. Brands, The First American, The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief, James Bennett. And Jeff Nunberg considers Bernard Goldberg's charge that the news media have a liberal bias. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with James Bennett, the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been covering both sides of the Middle East conflict. He was in Jerusalem when we recorded our interview this morning. Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia has a plan that he's proposed, which is that Israel withdraw to its boundaries from before the 1967 war, which would basically mean getting all the settlements out of the West Bank and Gaza. And in return, Arab countries would normalize relations with Israel. Anything else you want to flesh out about that plan before we talk about its implications?
Well, they're still wrestling with the actual shape of the plan, which is expected to be the major topic of conversation at the Arab summit next week in Beirut. There's been some debate over how specific they want to get about various issues, such as the right of return that Palestinians demand. The thinking now seems to be to leave it as vague as possible, because the more specific it gets, the more there is essentially to shoot at in the document. And they want to keep it, I think, at the moment anyway, from what I've been told by Palestinian officials, they want to keep it more of a slogan or a vision for what could happen if there were an Israeli withdrawal.
What would it mean for Israel to return to 1967 borders?
It'd be excruciatingly difficult to return to the precise 1967 borders. Many Israelis regard the West Bank particularly, but also the Gaza Strip, as part of their biblical birthright. There are more than 200,000 settlers that live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip in houses built since 1967 by Israel, heavily fortified communities now. Israel has built a network of roads to those settlements. Many of these people refuse to leave, and when I interview some of them, they talk about resisting by force if Israel actually tried to pull them out. They talk about how much ammunition they've stored up, how many guns they have, and while they say it's a last resort, that they wouldn't want to have to take up weapons against fellow Israelis and fellow Jews, that they would do it if they were pushed to the wall.
On the other hand, what does it mean for a Palestinian state if there are many Israeli settlements within the Palestinian state? And this assumes that the Palestinian state would be the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, it's very, very difficult to have a contiguous state as long as these settlements are here, because they've effectively broken up the West Bank into cantons, in a sense. And the protected roads that the Israelis use to reach these settlements divide up the Palestinian territory. It's very hard for a Palestinian to literally to cross from one side of this road to the other. So they function almost as de facto barriers throughout the West Bank. And Palestinians regard them simply as a daily affront to their dignity, their own rights, that was the land on which their father, their grandfather, their grandfather's grandfather grew olives or oranges, and they want it back. Now, under the last round of serious peace negotiations between the two sides more than a year ago, there was an effort to swap land, to trade some land elsewhere in Israel for the land that the settlements now occupy, so that Israel wouldn't have to uproot all the settlements, that it could retain some of the major ones by compensating the Palestinians with land elsewhere. And in the end, there may be some sort of formula like that reached that wouldn't force Israel to give up some of the major settlements where now tens of thousands of Israelis live.
You know, the Saudi peace plan is something that's being talked about, but the Bush administration is pushing the Tenet peace plan, which is the peace plan that was created by the head of the CIA. What's that plan about, and what's the temperature on each side on that plan?
Well, like so much here, it's extremely arcane and hard to understand, but critically important. It was a plan negotiated months ago, by George Tenet to try to create enough of a peace to bring the parties to another plan called the Mitchell Plan, which would then take them back to serious negotiations. So, Terry, in a sense, we've had a series of kind of receding prefaces, We had negotiations. Then there was a plan created, the Mitchell plan, to get us to the negotiations. Then there was a new plan, the tenant plan, to get us to the Mitchell plan, to get us to negotiations. And now the Bush administration is trying to get both parties back to the tenant plan. The problem is that even though both sides effectively agreed to this plan, they're still arguing over exactly what it would involve and what the timing would be. General Zinni's entire goal right now is to get the parties to engage and to start this so-called tenant plan, which essentially involves a serious crackdown by the Palestinians on violence, including the very difficult step of actually collecting illegal weapons and putting more and more of these militants in jail. On the Israeli side, it would require a pullback from all Palestinian territory that they've occupied since the beginning of this uprising. They date it to September 28, 2000, that Israeli forces would essentially return to where they were on that date. And it would return the parties back, supposedly, to where they were then, and then enable them to go forward with this Mitchell plan. The problem is neither side agrees on when they would do the particular steps. Should the Palestinian steps all come first and then the Israeli withdrawal? Should they happen at once? Should the whole thing take 10 days, which is what the Palestinians say? Or should it take 2 to 4 weeks, which is what the Israelis say? The devil is in the details here. And while they did agree on these agreements, they never agreed on what the agreements mean.
One of the big sticking points in the Middle East peace talks has been the Palestinians' right of return. For Israel, if Palestinians returned to Israel, that would kind of end the Jewish state. What does the right of return mean to Palestinians?
For Palestinian refugees, it means the opportunity to go home. Quite literally, for some, it means the opportunity to move back into the house that they once had in what are now Israeli cities like Haifa and Jaffa, Ashkelon. For others, it's a little less specific than that. They want to be able to move into Israel to return to their home cities. They realize that their houses themselves are now destroyed or gone. But it's a very, very powerful dream that's been nurtured over the generations to go home again. They say that Israelis essentially are invoking their own right of return. That is, by coming to the West Bank, Jews say that they're returning to land held by Jews 2,000 years ago. Palestinians say, well, if that's reasonable, why isn't it reasonable for me to go back to a place where my family lived only 50 years ago?
Is there any room for compromise on this one? It's such a major issue on both sides, because for Israel it means, you know, if Palestinians return, they will have a majority and the Jewish state would be over. For Palestinians, it's one of the most important things on their agenda to have the right to return. Neither side wants to compromise on this, although there are some Palestinians, such as Sari Nusseibeh, who say, just give up on the right of return. It's never going to happen. Israel's never going to agree to that. So give up on it and move on.
That's right. It's very tough, though. Even Israeli left-wingers, the most left-wing Israelis, are still opposed to the right of return because they regard it as essentially an attempt by the Palestinians to do through demography what they can't do through force of arms and overwhelm Israel and change its Jewish character. For the Palestinians, this issue has been alive for so long. It's been used in some cases cynically by Palestinian leaders. That is, the refugee populations has essentially been maintained, not just by the Palestinians, but the Arab states generally, as kind of a running sore, an unaddressed political issue. There hasn't been much of an effort to assimilate the refugees into other populations and help them, in effect, go on with their lives. There's been some effort, again, during the last round of negotiations, there was an effort to develop some sort of menu of options, if you will, for Palestinian refugees, by which some would be encouraged to settle in other countries. They would receive cash compensation, and a limited number of them that would somehow be governed so it wouldn't grow large enough to alarm the Israelis. A limited number would be allowed to return so that there would be some symbolic recognition, therefore, by Israel of a right of return.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he's joining us from Jerusalem. I've heard a lot of people say that they think that there's no way there will be any real progress toward peace in the Middle East as long as Arafat and Sharon are the representatives at the table, because they're so old school and they're so caught up in the antagonisms of the past that they just can't see into the future. They can't let anything go. Is that sentiment shared, do you think, on both sides of the conflict now?
Yeah, it's quite widespread. Certainly Israelis believe there won't be peace as long as Arafat's there, and Palestinians believe there won't be peace as long as Sharon is there, and some people believe on both sides that both men have to go. To some extent, people here feel captive of a personal rivalry. The rivalry is both emblematic of the larger conflict between the two sides and also something very specific between these two men who hate each other. Sharon said recently that he wished Israel had killed Arafat when it had the chance 20 years ago in Beirut. I asked him about that the other day, and he said that he thought Sharon was still living in the past and stuck in 1982. But Arafat himself considers himself the only Arab general to have ever beaten Sharon. So there is this real sense that these two men, both in their 70s, both of whom have been fighting this conflict one way or another their entire lives, are so locked in this their own dispute and their own contest of wills that that neither is really capable of making the total change of mindset, really, and taking the enormous political risk it would require to achieve real peace.
The Israeli head of state changes fairly frequently with elections. Arafat has been the leader of the Palestinians for decades. Is there anyone waiting in the wings who would replace him if Arafat stepped down, or if he was, you know, forced out by his own people?
There are certainly a lot of people waiting in the wings who would like to replace them, although they publicly insist on their loyalty right now. There is a formal process for the two essentially overarching Palestinian organizations, the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. There is a process for Yasser Arafat to be replaced in each of the leadership positions he holds in those two organizations, but the men that are likely to take those positions, known popularly as Abu Allah and Abu Mazen, are regarded by many Palestinians as, sad to say it, but they're seen as too compromising, too willing to make peace, not militant enough at this point. Neither side would expect them to be able to hold on to power very long should there be a real, should Yasser Arafat be replaced. Then the question passes to who would take over. The many possible scenarios have been played out here on both sides. There's some thinking that there would be a period of chaos and cantons, that individual warlords in different Palestinian areas who become very popular during the course of this conflict in places like Jenin in the northern West Bank, places like the Rafah refugee camp in southern Gaza Strip, that those people would essentially become local potentates. I think it's an Israeli hope in some quarters on the right that they would then be able to essentially divide and rule, cutting separate deals with each of these cantons. Palestinians say that they already have a state infrastructure, they have an apparatus, they would find a way to replace Arafat with another national leader capable of unifying the Palestinian areas. But exactly who that would be, it's not clear.
I think it's very, very difficult to cover the Middle East without one side or both sides accusing you of bias. Has that been an issue for you?
Oh, yeah. Any journalist here is constantly criticized by people on both sides for coverage that they regard as biased. Sometimes it's really, really vitriolic and personal offensive, and sometimes it's very thoughtful. And in the second case, it's obviously more disturbing than in the first, which is more easily dismissed. It's easy to say if you're criticized by both sides, then you must be doing the right thing, but that's not necessarily the case. So I think we all try to take the criticism seriously and evaluate the concerns, but passions are just so great on this subject, and people are so sensitive to even this tiniest detail, the word choice, the choice of story, what it is you decide to cover, what it is you decide you don't. And they often assume conspiracy when, in fact, it's a lot less less thought through than that, and a lot more chaotic. We're all doing our best to cover this conflict daily, and there's a lot of incoming news. Sometimes people understandably feel that their particular angle wasn't given enough play.
What are some of the things that you do to check yourself to make sure that, according to your own standards, that you are bias-free?
Well, each story I obviously read very, very carefully myself, and as I'm thinking it through and putting it together, I'm very careful to make sure that claims from one side are checked against the other side, that when Palestinians say X number of people died, and this is how the Israelis, I call the Israeli army, I call the police, I call whoever is in a position to know whether that's accurate or not and run it by them and check it, and the same is true on the other side. One of the frustrations in the job here is that the constant effort to achieve balance, to make sure we're not unfairly ruffling sensibilities on the one side or the other, could lead a reporter to overcompensate in the other direction, to create balance where balance does not exist, and in essence to fail to call things accurately. Some days, there are days when Palestinians suffer much more than Israelis, days when Israelis suffer much more than Palestinians. It's really our job, I think, to retain the kind of empathy for both sides in this conflict, for both the pain that they're experiencing and the fears that they have and their legitimate political views. We have to retain this kind of ability to understand each side's perspective that too often the people who are locked in the conflict itself lose. And that's really the greatest challenge in the job.
Just one last question. In your gut, do you feel like the violence is beginning to slow down a little bit and that the direction is heading a little more toward, you know, toward the peace table? Or do you feel not?
It's a mistake to venture any predictions here. It's one thing I've learned in the time I've been here. But I think at the moment, there is, everybody is taking a deep breath here. There is, I think, going to be something of a period of calm, relative calm. There won't be a halt-all attacks, I don't think. But with the Bush administration as reengaged as it is now, I don't think either side wants to humiliate the envoy here. And I think there's going to be some, it looks like we're headed towards at least some sort of short-term ceasefire agreement. In the long term, though, I'm not optimistic.
James Bennett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg considers the charge in Bernard Goldberg's bestseller that the news media have a liberal bias. This is Fresh Air. The former CBS News producer Bernard Goldberg has renewed an old controversy about liberal bias in the media. His book, Bias, has climbed to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Among other things, Goldberg claims that the media's bias is reflected in the unequal way they use political labels like conservative and liberal. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg is always interested in claims about language, and he decided to check this one out.
For the most part, Bernard Goldberg's charges of media bias are based on anecdotes, hearsay, and unsupported generalizations. But at one point, he strays into territory that can actually be put to a test. That's when he claims that the media pointedly identify conservative politicians as conservatives, but rarely use the word liberal to describe liberals. As Goldberg explains the difference, in the world of the Jennings and Brokaws and Rathers, conservatives are out of the mainstream and have to be identified. Liberals, on the other hand, are the mainstream and don't have to be identified. That basic premise is sound enough that the media mention things that they see as being out of the mainstream more often than they mention things that they see as in it. If a major company names a 7-foot-tall Hare Krishna from Tonga as its CEO, those attributes are more likely to show up in the story than if the new chief is a 5'10 Methodist from Ohio. But does that difference really show up in the way the media deal with liberals and conservatives, too? TV newscasts aren't easy to check, and Goldberg doesn't offer any research to back up his claim. But Goldberg and the other critics of media bias also make their charges about the language of the press, which is available online. So I went to a big online database and did a search on the articles from about 30 major newspapers, including the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Miami Herald, and the San Francisco Chronicle. For purposes of comparison, I took the names of 10 well-known politicians, 5 liberals and 5 conservatives. On the liberal side were Senators Boxer, Wellstone, Harkin, and Kennedy, and Representative Barney Frank. On the conservative side were Senators Lott and Helms, John Ashcroft, and Representatives Dick Armey and Tom DeLay. Then I looked to see how often each of those names occurred within 5 words of liberal or conservative, whichever was appropriate. Of course, some of those hits involved extraneous noise, say when the word liberal just happened to find itself near Barbara Boxer's name with no real connection between the two. But when I checked a sample of the results by hand, it turned out that more than 85% of them did in fact involve the assignment of a political point of view, with phrases like Paul Wellstone, the liberal senator, or Senate conservatives like Jesse Helms. And with a sample of more than 100,000 references to the names, the results were statistically sound. And I did find a big disparity in the way the press labels liberals and conservatives, but not in the direction that Goldberg claims. In fact, the average liberal legislator has a 30% greater likelihood of being identified with a partisan label than the average conservative does. The press describes Barney Frank as a liberal 2.5 times as frequently as it describes Dick Armey as a conservative. It gives Barbara Boxer a partisan label almost twice as often as it gives one to Trent Lott. And while it isn't surprising that the press applies the label conservative to Jesse Helms more than to any of the other Republicans in the group, it describes Paul Wellstone as a liberal 20% more frequently than that. At first, I wondered whether I'd inadvertently included a bunch of conservative newspapers in my sample. So I did the same search in just 3 papers that are routinely accused of having a liberal bias: the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times. But in those papers, too, liberals get partisan labels 30% more often than conservatives do, the same proportion as in the press at large. The tendency isn't limited to politicians, either. For example, Goldberg writes that it's not unusual to identify certain actors, like Tom Selleck or Bruce Willis, as conservatives, but Barbara Streisand or Rob Reiner are just Barbara Streisand and Rob Reiner. But actually, that's dead wrong, too. The press gives partisan labels to Streisand and Reiner almost 5 times as frequently as it does to Selleck and Willis. For that matter, Warren Beatty gets a partisan label twice as often as Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Norman Lear gets one more frequently than Charlton Heston does. It's the same with other figures. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is identified as a liberal more often than Justices Rehnquist, Scalia, or Thomas are identified as conservatives. And the columnist Michael Kinsley gets a partisan label more often than George Will does. I found the results surprising, not because I assumed that the press had a liberal bias, but because liberal has become such a problematic word that nobody seems to want to use it. Since the Reagan era, the right has gone after it as the L word, to the point where a lot of politicians are nervous about owning up to being liberals. And people on the left have always been suspicious of the term, which is why a lot of them prefer to think of themselves as progressives. But nobody ever talks about the C word, and people on the right are always happy to call themselves conservatives. I'd have figured that all that would make the press a bit reluctant to use the liberal label, too. But it turns out that newspapers label liberals much more readily than they do conservatives. Of course, it's possible that things work differently on TV newscasts. But that's pretty unlikely, unless you're willing to assume that the language we hear on CBS and ABC has a much more liberal slant than what we get in the Washington Post and the New York Times. If there is a bias here, in fact, the data suggests that it goes the other way, that the media consider liberals to be farther from the mainstream than conservatives are. Or maybe sometimes it's just a case of the press bending over backwards to avoid the charge of bias. The one thing that's certain is that there's another bias operating here as well, the one that leads media critics to hear what they want to hear.
Jeff Nunberg is a senior researcher at Stanford Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Frank Sinatra singing In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. The composer who wrote the song, David Mann, died earlier this month at the age of 85. He also wrote There I Said It Again and was President Harry Truman's official White House pianist for 8 months.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of counting sheep. When your lonely heart has learned its lesson, you'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss her most of all.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Love, Greg and Lauren, a husband's day-by-day account of his wife's remarkable recovery. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Serge Popovic, one of the founders of the Serbian student group that helped overthrow the president of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic. Now Popovic is a member of parliament. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.